According to the U.S. Department of Energy, solar energy is the most abundant energy resource that's available on Earth. So I guess we can figure out the best ways to harness it. Certainly a good use of our time. And today we're going to talk about what some researchers are doing along those lines here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, turning sunlight into electricity through the use of dyes and fabrics. Have you ever thought about that? John Greenler has thought about it. John's the director of education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute with us today again. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be here.
And one of the people who is actually doing research on this is Tricia Andrew. She's an assistant professor of chemistry in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Tricia, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it. Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. As you listen in, what excites you about the possibility of alternative energy? Would you pay a little more to know that the energy you were using is coming from a renewable and sustainable resource? How about dyes and fabrics? What kinds of questions might you have about how we turn dyes and fabric into energy? Call in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Tricia Andrew, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us as well.
Thank you, Larry. This is quite the privilege.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us, a chemistry background. And you are working with some other folks here on campus.
Yes, I just started working with Marianne Fairbanks. She's also an assistant professor at the School of Human Ecology. She's a weaver, as I call her.
Well, you're weaving a pretty good story together here, I think. Can we talk about solar cells? How does a solar cell take sunlight and turn it into electricity?
So it's a basic two-step process. There's light absorption and then electricity generation. So light, we in this case think about it as a particle, so a photon. A photon of light hits a solar cell. The solar cell absorbs it, and it creates something called an excited state. And the wonderfulness of physics is basically an excited state is nothing more than a electron, a negative charge, and a positive charge that are tightly bound together. And so when this photon is absorbed, you create a tightly coupled electron and a hole, or a positive charge. And then the solar cell, what it does is the electric field within that solar cell pulls those charges apart. And so what you end up doing is basically creating a distance between your electron and your hole, and that creates an electric field, and that's your power, that's your voltage. And so it's pretty much as simple as that: photon absorption, electricity generation.
I'm sure it's not quite as easy as that, how that sounds, John.
It is, you know.
It is in some ways and not in others.
It's a classic example, I think, of the devil's in the details of how to actually, you know, make that happen at the molecular level, and then to be able to take advantage, you know, of that that energy differential to actually get all the way to the point where you can flip the switch in your home and have your light come on. But, you know, as Tricia was saying, really, when you get down to the chemistry and physics of it, it's pretty straightforward.
Well, how do dyes, now we talk about dyes and fabrics, how do dyes fit into this?
So it goes back to me, at least in my mind, the first part of that equation, photon absorption. You need something to absorb light. And when you think about dyeing something else, if you just want to dye a piece of plastic or your fabrics, you don't really think about, hey, I'm going to put silicon on there to make it colorful, because silicon's not really a dye, right?
Yep.
And so dyes really do the photon absorption much better than anything else that we have tangible on Earth. The problem in that case is basically, how do you get that excited state, again, the electron and the hole, how do you separate it as efficiently as silicon does? So silicon's really great at creating free charges, but it's really horrible at absorbing light. And so what my research has been throughout my training and also my independent career has been trying to figure out, how do you take dyes that are used for nothing else than to color things and actually make them feasible in an electronic device, so you could separate those charges and create an electric field.
That's pretty cool stuff. Yeah, I was just thinking, 2 weeks ago, my daughter had a doubleheader softball game and fast pitch game, and I'm sitting in the stands, and I'm suddenly realizing I'm wearing a black shirt, and it is sunny, And I was thinking about you.
That's wonderful. Because,
Oh, man, I'm roasting to death in this shirt. And so there's a dye, a black dye that really that absorbs a lot of heat.
Exactly. I mean, you're feeling hot because the dye in your shirt is absorbing light, and then there's nothing else to do with that excited state other than to create heat, right? And so if we just figure out how to put that in an electrical device and actually create an electric field, well, you have power.
Then you could have been charging your phone while you were sitting at the ball game.
Precisely.
Well, you know what? That's not a bad idea, as a matter of fact. You know, you should. How did you guys get together? I think that's an interesting story in and of itself.
Marianne and I. Mm-hmm. So there was a story that from my lab about how we made solar cells on paper, and it was related to our current project with textiles. And so Marianne joined the university about 2 years ago, and she Googled solar Wisconsin, and my name came up, and she just decided to drop me an email. And I usually, if the email is worded well, I usually respond to it. And she was a fellow colleague of mine. So, of course, I said, let's have a chat. So we had a coffee. And it was very fortuitous in my mind because she emailed me at a time when it was good that we made paper solar cells, but you're not really sitting there drinking your morning coffee, reading the paper, saying, I really wish this paper had a solar cell on it. And so I was really happy that we could demonstrate proof of concept. But in my own head, I was kind of worried about where this would really go and be useful. So Marianne basically emailed me right around that time when I was feeling a little doubtful about my own research. And she brought to me this idea of having integrating solar energy harvesting technology into textiles. Marianne actually had a startup where she stitched in flexible cadmium telluride solar cells onto bags and clothing and shirts and things like that. And she came to me with the idea of having it be more aesthetically pleasing and more organic. And in her case, she had to literally cut out, say, a panel of a bag to stitch in the solar cell. And it was very unwieldy and ugly. And also the mechanical properties of the bag, you couldn't really bend the solar cell that much. So she was fascinated with the idea of creating a piece of fabric and then growing a solar cell on top of it. And that basically hooked me up. I was like, I never thought about textiles before. That's awesome. Because, you know, now it's not like a New York Times with a solar cell on it, because who cares? But now we're talking about solar curtains, and we're talking about tents that could possibly generate power when you're in remote locations that could be useful for the army. So that's how it started, an email and a willingness to say, let's go for it.
I love that story. You know, there's so much of what happens on this campus and other campuses as well is the serendipitous discovery among people, among researchers.
I think it is something that is done really well here at UW-Madison. The collaboration across, you know, colleges, across mm-hmm. departments, I think is truly exceptional.
Yeah. Well, Mike in Greenbush has a comment. Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I am somewhat of a renewable pioneer, and I always am trying to figure out the best use for an electron. Richard Feynman, the physicist who helped on the Manhattan Project, would come up with an idea. He said, now, if I were an electron, what would I want to be used for? So my question, well, my observation is that electrons are too valuable to use for heat because there are so many more sources of function, and the best use for an electron is to do work. Now, the question after that is, what kind of work should an electron do? Two things, pumping air and pumping water. And pumping water is the most cost-effective use for any solar application. The ranchers in the Texas Panhandle have been doing it for decades. So my pet peeve is when people use solar for things that are absolutely, I call it inappropriate, for illumination, for heating, for anything else. Roughly 20-25% of our electricity in this country is used to pump water, and there's where solar really needs to go. On a municipal, massive scale, for example, the city of Milwaukee, pumping water out of Lake Michigan, pumping water back into Lake Michigan. On sunny days, we could have solar flush toilets because ultimately that water could be pumped by solar power.
Well, what do you think? We've got a John, we'll start with you.
Mike, you know, you're right on track in terms of consideration of that relationship between energy and water. I think it's one that's not really appreciated. There's in the past year even, there's been a lot of increased study and research in what's now being called the water-energy nexus, and recognizing, you know, that interrelationship. And it is tremendous, you know, the amount of water that we use to generate electricity, and the amount of electricity that we use to do what we want to do with water. In fact, even just last week, there was a kind of a conceptualizing conference took place in Milwaukee, trying to really bring together entrepreneurs and businesses that are in these two domains to really try and do more work in that space of water and energy. And I know the same is true. The Department of Energy funds a National Renewable Energy Lab out in Colorado, and they're doing a lot of work in this space as well. So we really need to look at that, as clearly, you know, our energy needs continue to increase, and clearly, you know, our freshwater supply becomes more and more precious. It's really interesting to think about best use of different types, different forms of energy for different purposes. I think, you know, that best fit concern is really critical. So thinking about where those electrons go is right on track. So,
right on track.
You know, I'll just put in a brief plug at this point in time. I know that will come up to some extent, at least, coming up on October 13th here in Madison at the UW-Madison Union South. We'll have our annual energy summit, and this is something that is largely organized by the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And so you can go to energy.wisc.edu and learn more about that summit. And I'm pretty sure that we'll have a session looking exactly at that interrelationship.
Ah, very interesting. So anyone eligible to
anybody, you know. It's a very wide-ranging audience. We have people from the general public, clearly people from academia and industry as well. So it's really meant to be, you know, an intersection for all parties who are interested in energy.
And Mike, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you want, post a note on our Facebook page. We have some Facebook page comments, and we'll get to those. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at some research being done in the energy area. Tricia Andrew is an assistant professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, working with others to develop dyes and fabrics to turn sunlight into electricity. So she's with us today, as is John Greenler, Director of Education for the Wisconsin Energy Institute and for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Certainly, you are welcome to join in, and I hope you will, with your own questions or comments about this. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. We do have a Facebook comment from John in Mason, Wisconsin. Says one of my ideas has always been window shades that you pull down, and they are solar panels on the window side to absorb the sun's rays. That would use both UV during the day and infrared at night and on cloudy days, because infrared radiation is always present. So what do you think about that, Tricia?
I think that's a great idea, and that's what we're angling towards ultimately with our products. So one of the great things about using dyes, organic dyes in particular, is that you could use chemistry to tune which parts of the spectrum they absorb in. And so we actually have made transparent solar cells, which I call them transparent, quote unquote, because they're transparent as far as human eyeballs are concerned, but they actually absorb in the UV and in the near infrared, and they don't basically absorb in the visible region where we observe it. So when you actually put this against a window, it generates a photovoltage simply by absorbing exactly as the idea was UV and infrared light. And you can only get away with doing that because you're using a dye that's tailor-made. The structure is tailor-made to absorb everywhere except the visible.
How do you make that?
So it's something we our chemists call a structure property relationship. So it goes back to the idea that the molecular structure completely determines the physical properties of the material, and that tunability exists particularly for organic molecules and dyes. And that's why you could basically go to an artist shop and say, I want this particular shade of blue. I want cerulean and not, you know, I don't know, periwinkle. I think that's purple though. Anyways, but, you know, there's a lot of dye chemistry that has been around for about 300 years. So chemists really understand really well how to make a particular shade of color.
Okay, and then you, as I was reading a piece on this, and there's ways, or you're working on ways to kind of use threads, different threads to kind of work together to make this all happen?
So this is Marianne's and my kind of out there Star Trek idea, but we, as we got working on this collaboration, we were simply coating things on fabrics that were pre-made. And then we started to think about how can we actually weave together the material, because as I said before, Marianne is a weaver. And we asked the question of, well, can she get different kinds of threads that I give to her that are special coated in some way? And then she weaves them together in a pattern where the weaving actually creates a contact between the thread, and that serves as an electrical contact point. And so this is still out there right now, but we haven't shown proof of concept yet, but that was our ultimate idea, because then if that actually works, then we can actually weave together a solar cell in a loom, in a fabric loom, and that has never been thought of before. Solar cells are made in ultra-high vacuum facilities with, you know, very hot temperatures and things like that.
Wow. So you might, my old friend Jeannie Dosh-Weimuth, who's a weaver, might be able to do that in her own home someday?
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Whatever. She's also a designer, so and her, and so I'm picking up here that this could be very attractive as well as.
Absolutely, because, I mean, and it's actually very productive, because the key now to get solar harvesting technology out into much broader use is actually manufacturing. It's not figuring out the fundamental science or coming up with a technology. It's actually how to manufacture that technology in high throughput, right, high module output. And your weaving is a very, very basic form of high throughput manufacturing. And you can't really think about how I weave a solar cell together because you can't weave silicon. But if we now make that possible, then that just opens up an avenue that's amazing.
Amazing. Gosh. It's got to be fun for you, John, working with all these bright people.
I love these kinds of paradigm shifts. You know, it's just a whole different way of thinking about, you know, a form of technology, you know, woven into a sense of aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Jane and Ashlyn, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to see the University of Wisconsin pick up what they were working on many decades ago, and they just dropped it. But you could look it up and start it again. It's solar cooking and the use for producing heat by solar thermal and using it.
Yeah.
Many, many ways.
Well, John, I don't think we've abandoned that, have we, or have we?
No, it hasn't been abandoned, that's for sure. You know, and I think there's a special interest at this point in time, kind of in the domain of appropriate technology, especially when we begin to look at developing countries, you know, remote locations where we don't have access to the grid or maybe can't even afford today's, you know, current photovoltaic technology. This kind of, you know, solar cooking technology is actually, you know, very actively being researched, you know, and deployed in countries, sub-Saharan Africa, et cetera. So there is a lot of work going on in that area. Some of it is still in the research mode, and clearly some of it's in the you know, development and deployment areas as well. So this, you know, it's still something that's very important, very real, and is being very actively worked on.
And there's still a lot going on in terms of solar for buildings and all that sort of thing right here in this country.
Right. I mean, you'll frequently see, you know, solar thermal, which is, you know, essentially heating up water for, you know, for hot water use, you know, directly in parallel with photovoltaics. It's really, you know, very common to see installments where those two technologies are being used in parallel, whether it's at, you know, the scale of a home or commercial scale as well. So that thermal domain is still very much, you know, in utilization, and I think, you know, in research and development as well.
And thanks, Jane, good comments. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to Tricia. I want to talk about these materials that go into the threads, and I'm thinking in terms of cost. You know, I'm thinking it's possible that this could the cost of this could be fairly low or fairly reasonable.
Well, yes and no. So absolutely, yes, the cost of the dyes themselves are one of the reasons I are very low. One of the reasons I started working with them or like working with them, other than saying that I take car paint and make solar cells out of them, is that these dyes are actually made on kiloton scales a year. And for to put that number in perspective, silicon, elemental silicon, which is used to power every single small to large electronic that we use in our lives these days, is produced globally in about 35 kilotons a year. Okay, but take blue car paint, for example, one of my favorite molecules. The molecule is called copper thallocyanine. Copper thallocyanine is produced just in the state of, or country of Germany in about 75 kilotons a year. So that's roughly three times the volume in just one country alone. And a kiloton of copper thallocyanine costs about 17 American cents. So the material cost is very, very small, okay? But I will kind of qualify my statement a little bit. What we're really aiming for here in terms of cost of the ultimate device is module cost. So, and then there's another balance of systems cost associated with that. So within the module cost itself, the if you break it down and you say, I'm going to pay $1 for a square meter of a silicon solar cell, and you ask me how many of my cents from that dollar are going into material, well, honestly, it's only about 8 cents that goes in and pay for the silicon. Okay, so my little spiel about using cheap car paints, it's cute and all, but I will admit that I'm really only saving you about 8 cents at best. The rest of the module, it's the glass that costs the largest. So this is the amazing part about, again, solar technology these days, is when you buy a solar panel, you're mostly paying 91% of your money is going to pay for the glass on which it is built. And that's why I got a new flexible technology, because taking away the glass part, that is the true revolution.
And so that's going to be a lot cheaper.
Yes. Simply because I'm not building my devices on glass.
It is interesting. There's a lot of talk, in solar these days about efficiency and how do you increase the efficiency of the, of your solar panel. And that is an important consideration. But really, the ultimate concern is what does it cost per watt, per unit of electricity, per unit of energy. We want to be as efficient as possible with those electrons we were talking about earlier and capture as many as we can. But really, at this point in time, we're getting pretty good at that. And trying to drive that price down further and further, in terms of units of electricity is really becoming important. So
yeah,
all the wrappings are very critical.
We have Adam in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Adam. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I had some questions regarding radiant energy and curious to see if there's any knowledge. I'm a developer of an alternative energy wind system. And early in my research, I came across and really delved into Thomas Henry Morey. He was a researcher at the early part of the 20th century that proved a way of converting radiant energy into electricity. And for something in the neighborhood of 20 years, he traveled around the country with this little 8 by 10-inch or 14-inch box, had a lead wire coming off of it, and he would fire up like 10 or 15 light bulbs and add a 500-watt iron into it, and the light bulbs wouldn't dim. And he was, researched by other individuals, and all the individuals claimed to have the scent of ozone. And so that kind of sparked me to portion of the energy into electricity and the process of it.
So we got radiant energy, radiant heat.
Boy, I'm drawing a bit of a blank. It is interesting thinking about the note that your comment about the ozone and just trying to think about the chemistry and what that might indicate. I mean, clearly. Ozone is something you don't want to make a lot of. Initially, actually, I did think it had medicinal qualities, but today we recognize that it's a major air quality issue. But I'm trying to work that backwards and figure out what might be going on there.
Well, when you have black body radiation, so in my labs, we use a UV lamp all the time to do our normal chemistry, and the UV lamp actually does generate a little bit of ozone. So if you have, there's an energy threshold, though, before there's enough power density before the oxygen gets converted into ozone. So if you put out enough black body radiation in the ultra high UV region, you will generate ozone. So I suspect with, I forget how many pounds of iron you said, but with that hanging around, it's probably putting out a lot of high density UV power, basically. And that's enough to basically create ozone from oxygen out there.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Adam. Appreciate it. We had a question from Mike in Ocano Falls, who says, I have a solar collector that works underneath my lamp. Would it be possible to harness energy from large lights in factories similar to how my calculator works?
Yes, absolutely. And I love that whole concept of solar collectors. And it's another issue where it, to me as a scientist, is really exciting optics and all that. But also the issue with scaling this up for again, civilization, generating power for human civilization is a tricky issue. So first, there's two kinds of solar collectors out there. There's a normal kind, and it's effectively what is called a Fresnel lens. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like those magnifying sheets that you use to basically help you read small text better. It's exactly the same thing, except on a much, much larger scale. And then the other kind of collector is called an solar organic collector, organic solar concentrator. So the Fresnel lenses, the ones that you find right now, the problem with them is heating. So when you're basically out there, the Fresnel lenses collect not only the visible light from the sunlight, but also the infrared light. And so the focal point of them is just one huge heat source.
Yeah.
And so then you need to cool them down. And then the power it takes, for example, from our first caller of pumping water through to cool down the collector, basically gates out your overall energy gain. All right. The second one, which is I'm a proponent of, and I'll speak quickly here, organic collectors. It's another kind of idea similar to ours of using dyes to collect the light and then just funnel them into a solar cell. So instead of having large, unwieldy solar cells collecting the light, you cut out the area with just a dye that's absorbing the light and then shuttling in using some kind of total internal reflection process to the solar cells themselves. I will admit to say that was actually the first company that I started as a graduate student with some fellow colleagues. We found very quickly that company does not exist anymore. We found very quickly that our efficiency needed to be greater than that permitted by solid state physics in order to actually make a difference in that case. And also,
that's not going to happen.
It's not. And the idea was actually patented by a Caltech professor in 1976. And there's no technology out there now, so we should have known better before. But we were young. And, well, anyway.
Well, you weren't foolish. You were not young and foolish.
We were brave.
You were young and brave.
That's probably learned a lot in the process.
Yes.
That's a better way to put it, for sure. Dwight in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Dwight.
Hello. 3 years ago, there was a show on TV called Beyond Tomorrow, and there was a guy that was working with the material was like saran wrap, and he had like rays of colors across them that they were like a solar panel, and his theory was, you could just lay this stuff out on roofs or anything. And then they were also working on a paint that you paint your house and it would produce electricity. So I'm wondering, is this the kind of stuff that you're working with when you're talking about flexible materials?
Absolutely. It's a very similar situation. I think there's two people that you may be referring to, but either way, we're all in the same community and we're all working on flexible electronics. And the idea here is, you either find a material that you're trying to optimize, which is what's true in my case, or you're trying to build the device better. But we're all in the same community together and we call ourselves the flexible organic electronics people. But it's exactly the same idea.
Well, so what are let's think about the range of opportunities with the work that you're doing.
Well, our idea is, as I said before, we're making solar curtains. So what's unique about my technology or the way I actually build the solar cell is that I could take any pre-made substrate that you send me, anything as crazy as paper or textiles, I can't think any crazier than that, and I simply grow a material on top of that pre-existing substrate. And the thickness of the ultimate device I grow is about 100 nanometers.
When you say grow, what do you mean by grow?
So it's sort of like a vapor coating process. So I stick this process in a chamber, and the chamber is then filled with the vapor of my materials in subsequent, or in sequence, excuse me. And so I'm basically directly coating my solar cells on whatever substrate you find, and the final thickness is only 100 nanometers, about 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. And so the underlying mechanics and mechanical properties and flexibility of whatever substrate you give me are preserved. And so what that allows me to do is simply create this electronic device on something that has its own flexibility or a lack thereof, and its own tensile strength or a lack thereof. And so what we're thinking about doing is solar curtains, and we're more interested in tents and things like that, things for camping and also defense applications. So think about the 80-pound backpack that a Marine carries around all the time, and then they're, you know, if you add a battery charger or something like that into that backpack, that's actually quite a load. Mm-hmm. But if the backpack itself were coated with our technology in order to have a solar cell, then the backpack itself serves as a energy collection source for a Marine out on the field, something like that. Yeah. So that's what we're ultimately aiming towards. And then I love Marianne Fairbanks, my collaborator, and she had the idea of a space elevator, and I thought that was the most out there dreamer idea that she had. So I'll just put that in there as well.
A space elevator. All right. Tell me what a space...
There was this idea kind of almost in the ignoble science sense in our community for a while about having a material that was able to be built up from the ground up to a satellite, and so serve as a elevator from a satellite that's collecting, you know, solar flux from the outer atmospheres and then shuttling it down to Earth. And so we were like, well, maybe you could coat that fictional thing if it exists.
So now when we've got this material and we've got it as a curtain or whatever, how would you conceive of the energy going from the curtain to wherever it needs to go?
So our substrate is actually one of our bottom electrodes, and then we deposit an array of our top electrodes in a kind of pattern that looks aesthetically pleasing right on top of it. And then we wire the arrays together. So we basically think about it like Christmas lights, and each of the bulbs in the Christmas light is an individual device that we grow, and they're all wired together, and they can be icicle lights or they can be normal Christmas tree lights. So that's the pattern that we actually grow on. And so the pattern that you see just looks pretty, but it's actually electrically all connected in either series or parallel. And so we end up having basically two leads at the end of our substrate that you could hook up to your wall outlet or to directly to your phone or something like that.
Or a battery system if you wanted to store it for nighttime use.
Yeah, that'd
whatever.
Be great.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Wow. So at what stage are you in this whole process?
Well, on the growing the device onto the textile part, we have a device that generates photovoltage, which we're very excited about. On the weaving aspect, which is the more crazy thing that we're doing, we're very much in the beginning stages there. So,
yeah, and how is your work funded?
Right now, we're funded through the Department of Defense, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, and through a grant from the Wisconsin Graduate School.
Well, I'm just amazed at this whole process. I think I could envision far. Of course, I'm probably one of these way out type persons, but I mean, I could envision it for clothing, and
that would be awesome. Yeah, that's one of our first products that we're trying to really kind of work toward.
But yeah, the opportunities are really so wide. I mean, clearly, you know, here in the States, we have the privilege of having, you know, our electrical grid. But when we think about developing countries where, you know, they're so far away from having the infrastructure for that. So, you know, to the ability to have affordable, portable, approachable, you know, photovoltaic systems, remote villages and developing countries, Africa, once again, et cetera, I think, you know, is really, really a tremendous opportunity.
Well, I can
the
think
adaptability.
And you think about the difference between having this glass, mm-hmm. heavy and breaks and everything else, and having the fabric itself, which takes up much less space and certainly easier to move around.
A lot more portable.
You know, and someone mentioned the idea of rolling this out or up together, and that is key. I think that's actually a very powerful thing to do, to roll out a solar panel or not. And as John mentioned before, the devil's all in the details. And if you take any plastic substrate and you can roll it up, you actually do damage to the solar cell on a molecular level. You create cracks. And so the solar cell, after a few roll-ups and roll-outs, will basically stop functioning as it was when it was pristine. And that's where our idea of coating this stuff in a very thin layer, that's key, because rolling out process doesn't actually kill it, won't create cracks on it.
Right. Yeah. And this does get back to, you know, once again, it's like, you know, what is this all going to cost us? You know, there's that initial cost, but then the big question is, well, how long will a particular, you know, panel or system, last, whether it's 10 years or 40 years, makes a huge difference, because clearly, you know, the expense in these electrical power systems is all in, you know, you don't have to supply fossil fuels to keep it running, but that initial, you know, expense is a big one. So how long will that, you know, will that system remain functional for you is a really important concern.
Yeah, I was thinking about the weaving. I was thinking about my Christmas tree lights, which if I have the kind that if one bulb goes out, the rest still run. And I've had the other kind where one bulb goes out and then nothing works anymore. And so it sounds to me like with this weaving of the threads together, your contacts and that, you're going to have much longer. Like if there's some breakage, it's not going to kill the whole system.
Absolutely.
Alan in Appleton, I think, has had a really cool question. And he's just called in, so let's go to Alan. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I would like to know what kind of wattage per square foot are you talking about, I guess as far as actually being able to do something with it.
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's a great question. So the one downside with these organic materials is that their device efficiency is fairly low, so you need to have fairly large area. So at this time, our initial device that we have in the lab, my chambers can only accommodate a 5-inch square substrate. And so at this time, we've generated about 300 milliwatts of power. And to put that number in perspective, you need about a 1 watt of power to charge your cell phone. So 300 milliwatts is not quite enough, but it's getting there.
Moving right along. And thank you, Alan. That was a very good question. And it's kind of like everything else. You know, the first, I can remember a calculator that one of my professors bought and spent, I think it was like $1,400 for.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like 25 years ago, or maybe 30. And today, that same computer or that same calculator you can have for, 50 cents?
Yep, the beauty of microprocessors.
Right, an economy of scale. You know, the more you make of something like that, the less expensive it becomes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so along those same lines, I'm convinced that you are going to be able to develop materials that are going to be generating a whole lot more power and electricity per square inch.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate the confidence.
Boy, is it fun talking with you both. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Larry.
Thanks, Larry. Thank you.
John Greenler, Director of Education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Tricia Andrew is an Assistant Professor of Chemistry at the UW-Madison. It'll be fun to have them back and talk, you know, as time goes on. As they're making progress in this area, Tricia, you have to come back and bring your colleague with you from textiles.
Will do.
All right. Thanks again. Coming up, we have some other scientists that are going to be joining us, or at least one. I'm looking across my studio right now and seeing John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's one half of our Weather Guy team, and he is coming up next to talk with you and with me about the weather and maybe give us a fall forecast. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.